Work like a dog all day. Must be a better. Can't wait for every night to hold my baby tight. And when the times get tough, there's a way to rise above. Say, baby, make some love to me. Make some love to me. Make some love to me. All night long. Make some.
song Come to the Point by Steakhouse. That was released back in 2010. Before that, Three Little Words by the LA-based band 213. And the album, I think it was recorded in the 80s, but never got to be released until 2019. Before that, Do You Want to Make Some Love? And that track was actually unreleased from a Japanese exclusive album called Love You Out of Your Mind by Robert Byrne. Before that, It's Too Late by Hiroishi Keiko from her album All Weather Love, and that was from the year 1990. Before that, Table by Atsuko Nina. That one was from 1984. If you have enjoyed this past 40 minutes of music, you might want to check out some of WRCT's other offerings, such as Record Roulette. Give vinyl from our record library a spin. Listen to Record Roulette Thursdays at 10:30 p.m. only on WRCT. Or Lavender Hour, music to make your dye your hair purple. Fridays at 5 p.m. I wonder what kind of music they play. So yeah, definitely check it out. A lot of fascinating titles from the WRCT crate. Hey, did you know that WRCT is supported by Attic Records? It is located in Millvale, and it is an open 7 days a week. They sell new and used records and CDs from a range of genres, including rock, doo-wop, metal, reggae, and hip-hop. Attic Records is an independently owned and operated shop that purchases used records and CDs from collectors in bulk or by unit. Attic Records, located at 513 Grand Avenue in Millvale. For more information about selling records and new releases, is available at 412-821-8484 or at AttiRecordsStoreInc.com. When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear, vaping is not safe for youth because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs and dangerous things like metals into your body. And nicotine, which can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s. With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media, many kids think vaping is harmless. However, it is not. So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you. A message from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, www.samhsa.gov. Many good songs coming up here on WCD Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. You're listening to City Pop Central. And this song is called Never Too Far to Fall, composed and written by George Benson from his classic album In Your Eyes, 1983. No, never. Look at me. another absolutely fantastic song. Well, you know what they say, good time never lasts. Which is probably why it is almost nearing the end of this program. Here on WCD Pittsburgh 80.3 FM, I sincerely thank everyone who have stayed tuned for the past hour, and those who don't. Well, I hope you have a very good weekend and rest of your next week. This is DJ Lee on WCD Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. If you like the music you hear during the past hour, feel free to tune back in every Saturday night from 7 to 8 p.m. I will be here waiting for you. Good night, Pittsburgh. DJ Lee signing off.
look at the various gatherings, the big gathering they had at Carnegie Hall for the 75th birthday of Paul Robeson, and you'll find the Harry Belafonte's, all of the towering artists who knew that they owed a tremendous debt to Paul Robeson. It's very interesting at that gathering. I think one of the most powerful words were said by Coretta Scott King at that gathering. She was still mourning the death of Martin, and she said, "America did to Paul Robeson what I think they ended up doing to Martin. They buried him alive." See, Coretta's hitting on something deep. Inexcusable treatment of a person who had the courage to tell America about itself in regard to its injustices. They bury him alive.
That's Cornel West, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Cornel West on the legacy of Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is one of the 20th century's most enduring and multi-talented figures. He broke through the color line and excelled in sports, film, music, and theater. He became world famous, yet in the United States, he was to be persecuted and hounded for his political beliefs. In his recordings, particularly of spirituals and folk songs, Robeson's mellifluous bass baritone voice awakened African Americans to their heritage and gained him a broad audience. He won acclaim on Broadway, especially in the musical Showboat, in which he sang the classic Old Man River. His dramatic performance in Othello is legendary. By the 1930s, he was singing in major concert halls all over the United States and Europe. By the early 1940s, one biographer states that Robeson was the most famous black man in America. Theodore Dreiser, the well-known writer of the day, hailed Robeson as an artistic and social genius. Never content to be just an entertainer, Robeson had strong political views, and he wasn't afraid to express them. He condemned racism and segregation in the United States. He was an anti-imperialist who advocated the liberation of Africa and Asia from their European colonial masters. He was an early and vociferous opponent of fascism. He visited Spain and sang for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, who were fighting Franco. He admired the Soviet Union and said so openly. After World War II, the U.S. was saturated in the ideology of anti-communism. The Soviet Union, erstwhile ally, was now the arch enemy. Robeson's support for the USSR did not waver, and for it, he paid a heavy personal and professional price. He was a target of Hoover's FBI. He was verbally and physically assaulted and attacked. One notorious incident occurred in 1949 in Peekskill, New York. Robeson would later recall the baying of the lynch mob, the cries for my life from the hate-twisted mouths. In 1950, the State Department revoked his passport, declaring that Paul Robeson's travel abroad would be contrary to the best interests of the United States. Here is Robeson in his own words.
"And why do they take my passport away? They have said so in a case. They put it in a brief. They said that no matter what my political beliefs, what my standing among the Negro people of my own land in America, but they would have to take my passport away anyhow, because out of my own lips, mind you, from my own lips, for many years, I have been struggling for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa, and that is meddling in the foreign affairs of the United States government." Now, that's just too bad, because I'm going to have to continue to meddle.
Having his passport taken away was a tremendous blow to Robeson's career. He was not only unable to perform overseas, but he was blacklisted domestically. His income plummeted. The return of his passport in 1958 came too late. His final years were marked by depression and illness. He died in 1976 in relative obscurity. In recent years, because of important biographies by Martin Duberman and Lloyd Brown, as well as the work and efforts of others, there's a revival of interest in Paul Robeson. One can hardly imagine a better person to talk about Robeson's legacy than Cornel West. He's been called the preeminent African-American intellectual of his generation. He's the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Professor of Philosophy at Union Theological Seminary. With his preacher-like cadences and passionate delivery, he's much in demand as a speaker. A prolific author, his book Race Matters was a bestseller. He ran for president as an independent in 2024. Cornel West gave the first annual Paul Robeson Lecture at Columbia University Law School. This classic from the AR archives, marking Black History Month, was recorded in February 1999. And now, Cornel West.
I must say, I tremble as I rise and lift my voice to put forward reflections on Paul Leroy Robeson. There's levels of suffering, sacrifice, sadness, loneliness, courage that constitutes such a formidable challenge for us to dwell into the complexity of his life. I congratulate Columbia Law School for having the audacity to begin a lecture series in the name of the great Paul Leroy Robeson. Now, I know he's class 1923. He wasn't too crazy about the place, we should say. He had very, very pleasant memories of the dean at that time, Harlan Fiske Stone. And classmates like Thomas Dewey and William O. Douglas. But he zipped through. He didn't practice law for too long, just a few months after being hired by a firm, Stonesbury and Minor firm. And after working on the will of Jay Gould, he was just a stenographer who said, "I'll never take dictation from a nigger." And he decided maybe he ought to do something else with his life. Never took the bar. But in the best of the Columbia Law School tradition, his mind was sharpened. But as is true in most law schools, one wonders whether the mind is not only sharpened, but also in many ways narrowed. Can you sharpen your mind and at the same time broaden it, refine it, so that you have a sense of the whole rather than zero in the specialized, professionalized, routinized way in which so much of legal studies is often done? But you have no sense of what the larger calling actually is as public servant or as analyst for various firms who themselves have a collective and public responsibility. Paul Robeson, for me, terrifying. I've never had the gumption to speak publicly about Paul Robeson because he scares me. And you can bet your bottom dollar this is going to be the last lecture I give on Paul Robeson in a long time. Because it takes too much out of me. Well, let's begin where he would want us to begin, by situating him in a story bigger than himself, situating him in a set of narratives larger than himself, understanding Paul Robeson as a small part of a great, long, rich tradition of struggle. Going back to Robeson Plantation, Crossroads, Martin County, North Carolina, his father, William Drew Robeson, born a slave, escapes at the age of 15, makes his way to Pennsylvania, engages in farm labor to pay his way through Lincoln University. His father, an extraordinary person, himself part of a larger backdrop, a wave in an ocean of those who came before, of many thousands gone, obtains his A.B. at Lincoln University, his ministerial degree at Lincoln University, and makes his way to Princeton after meeting his lovely wife, Maria Louise Bustill, herself lineage of a grand tradition, grandfather from Sephardic Jews who encountered black folk in the New World, producing children like all of us, culturally hybrid. You see. And Princeton, of course, the very site where Paul Robeson was born, in his own words, spiritually located in Dixie, but geographically located in New Jersey. I happen to be a very proud holder of a Princeton degree, so I won't push this too far. But we know that Princeton was the only acceptable school for Southern elites. No accident, the first black went to Princeton in 1947, Harvard 1872, Columbia, you tell me. Princeton's always been behind when it comes to taking seriously the vicious legacy of white supremacy. Trying to catch up lately. God help them. Made some strides lately. But Paul Robeson was born in a Jim Crow context. His father was pastor of Witherspoon Street Presbyterian Church for over 20 years, but was pushed out because he was an outspoken critic of the Jim Crow situation in Princeton. Paul Robeson never forgot it. Paul Robeson had to leave Princeton when the father was pushed out. His mother died very tragically when he was six. She was brilliant. She wrote some of her husband's sermons, which is not typical in the black church. He moved a number of times to New Jersey, ended up in Somerville. His father had to change denominational affiliation to AME Zion because he couldn't deal with the deep racism in the Presbyterian church. And for many years, Paul Robeson lived alone with his father, the two of them. His father was 53 when he was born, an older man. Paul Robeson was a baby. Seven children, five survived. Paul Robeson had, in many ways, I'm saying, unbelievable privilege given the status of black folk at the time. A deep belief in himself, in his talents, in his capabilities. You see, he thought about going to Princeton, decided to go to Rutgers, though his father wanted him to go to Lincoln. And of course, the record at Rutgers is unbelievable. All American. Phi Beta Kappa in his junior year. Winner of the oratorical contest all 4 years, freshman year, sophomore year, junior year, senior year. First time Rutgers football team ever beat Princeton in the history of the game. You can imagine the smile that put on Brother Paul's face. And yet, as you can imagine, many schools like William and Mary and Georgia Tech refusing to play Rutgers as long as Paul was on the field. Graduates 1919. And then on to New York. Thinking about theater. Wrestling with the call of theater versus the call of law. And actually went through Columbia Law School while, in fact, he was an actor. I don't know how many of you are attempting that. It's a difficult thing to do, and it's not just a matter of learning lines in one context and memorizing cases in the other. But he pulled it off, and
during the time here at Columbia, he met the love of his life, his Landa Cardozo, good essay, herself Columbia grad. God bless you. Class of 1917, obtained the first position of a black person on staff at Presbyterian Hospital. Paul Robeson met her as patient in hospital with Essie as one administering to him. Long marriage, but we're talking about buffers, what he could fall back on. Why? Because we know in his life, from 1898 to 1976, he would need tremendous buffers in order to deal with the chilly whirlwinds, not just of white supremacy, but of Cold War, marginalization by mainstream black America, misunderstood, misconstrued, traveling around the world, doing what? Trying to keep alive this tradition of struggle. Always viewing himself as but one person to whom the baton had been handed to, and knowing he would have to hand that baton off to those who would come after. Paul Robeson, in many ways, reflects the plight and predicament of so many Americans, especially black Americans, who had attempted to do the same thing. Think of Frederick Douglass in 1893, 2 years before he dies. No blacks allowed the World Exposition in Chicago, but he, being representative of the State Department in Haiti, is able to attend as a Haitian, but not as a black American. Wrestling with a despair at the end of his life. Think of T. Thomas Fortune, that grand journalistic crusader, dies all by himself in an old dilapidated hotel in Trenton, New Jersey. Think of Zora Neale Hurston, working for white mothers as a maid after writing such literary texts. Her eyes are watching God, dying all alone. No tomb for the body. Think of Marcus Garvey by himself, London, Jamaica, late convert, Roman Catholicism, nearly forgotten. Think of Martin King's last years, the years that we would rather not think about. He's saying over and over again, America is so much sicker than I thought. White supremacy saturates and permeates every nook and cranny. I thought I had victory. Is it relatively hollow as a Pyrrhic? Think of W.B. Du Bois. 1961. Joins the Communist Party at the age of 93. Leaves 2 days later and says, I've spent my whole life trying to create a multiracial democracy. I cannot conceive of the masses of black people being treated decently and kindly and equally owing to the racist tilt of most of my fellow citizens of European descent, even given the heroic efforts of the well-intended ones. Take me to Ghana and don't ever bury one molecule of my body in America. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about a Paul Robeson. Not because he's perfect or pure or pristine, but because he had the courage to look himself, America, and the world in the face and say, I want to attempt to tell the truth about it. And anytime one attempts to show the ways in which our will to truth is untruthful about itself, the way in which the American will to truth is often untruthful about itself, you're going to suffer. We know about Paul Robeson's two suicide attempts. 1961, the wrist. 65, the scissors. The loving care of Paul Jr.
unbelievably loving care of Paul Jr. and his wife, Marilyn Rosenberg Robeson, to keep Paul going during those 11 years of darkness, reminding one of the last years of Nietzsche and Hurdling and others. Not madness, but on the brink. What a price to pay, given the fact that in 1944 and 1945, he was the loving Paul Robeson. Americans crazy about him, receiving awards from every major institution. Why? Because he was supporting the war effort. But so quickly it changes when you try to be a truth teller about America. Think of Muhammad Ali, truth teller, demonized. And after the progressive leaders and the black leaders are nearly dead, the political movements they represent, relatively dormant, they're then resurrected. King the same way every January. Now he's a hero. Now Robeson, oftentimes affirmed, appreciated. But not just his body dead and gone, but what he represented more and more feeble in our society. Where are the truth tellers and witness bearers like Paul Robeson? I want to highlight three fundamental questions in regard to Paul Robeson. And the question that I think pushed each and every one of us to the edge of life's abyss. The first question is, what does it really mean to be human? Especially coming out of a context in which one's humanity has been systematically called into question? What does it mean to be modern? Especially out of context in which the underside of modernity is the starting point. Slavery, Jim Crow, Jane Crow, second-class citizenship, desegregation. And third, what does it really mean to be American? Wrestling with the dark side of the American experiment. Three fundamental questions that have nothing to do with self-pity, nothing to do with PC, nothing to do with somehow ghettoizing and marginalizing Paul Robeson or the tradition out of which he comes. Each and every one of us have to come to terms with those three questions one way or the other. And Paul Robeson recognized that first question, what it means to be human, takes him back to the Latin root of our word human itself, humando, great Vico in the New Science. Paragraph 12 reminds us, humando means bearing. To be human has something to do with burying, has something to do with relating ourselves to mass corpses who are gone, has something to do with connecting us, the quick, to the dead, has something to do with bringing together the three dimensions of time, of past and present and future. That's something very un-American to have that kind of sense of history. How do we define who we are against the backdrop of those who came before, especially those significant others? In fact, I would go as far as to say, in many ways, we are most human when we stand before the coffin and have to relate ourselves and our lives to loved ones who are lying therein. It's also humbling. You could be a professor at the law school, or you could be a homeless brother outside, but you're going to have some similar shudders and quivers when you have to relate yourself to the corpse. And death, and the forms and varieties of death, sit at the center of the tradition of struggle that Paul Robeson represents. And one of the reasons why it's so very difficult to talk about race in America, because if in fact subjugated peoples, not just black folk,
working peoples, indigenous peoples, brown brothers and sisters, yellow women, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, that they have had to come to terms with social death of some sort. No legal status, no social standing, no public value. They've had to come to terms with the threats of spiritual death. You're nobody. You're less than. You see. Of course, black folk have had to come to terms both now and as well as the past with the bombardment of white supremacist claims of self-hatred. Telling the world that black folk have their own hips and lips and noses and hair texture and skin pigmentation. Less beautiful, less intelligent, always having to prove oneself as smart as rather than simply assume your capacity and do what you can with it. So much black intellectual energy and creativity has been channeled in the form of proving to the white mainstream that they're actually smarter than the stereotype that has been hegemonic. And often it's still a dead end. Because you've already given the very terrain upon which you're being defined. You'll never win that one. Jazz musicians don't have to worry about that. That's why they're freer than most law professors and law students of color. They've got different point of reference. I shouldn't say just law professors, professors in general. I'm including myself here, though, no doubt about that. No doubt about that. But we're talking about forms and varieties of death. Now, how do you talk about a people who are wrestling with forms of death in a death-dodging, death-denying, death-ducking civilization like America? Holding at arm's length. Already got a major challenge. How do you convince folk that in talking about your situation, you're not engaging in some kind of self-interested calculation? You're talking about something called public interest and common good and the destiny of the republic and the prospects of American democracy. More is at stake than just your particular situation. It's always fascinating to me when people talk about black folk or brown folk. It's always special interest. Talk about corporate America, American interest. Where'd that come from? Labor, special interest. Women, special interest. No, they all are constitutive components of the public interest and common good.
You're listening to Cornell.